Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Howard, and welcome to the Pure Animal Podcast. On today's episode, we talk to Dr. Naomi Boyd about veterinary physiotherapy and sports medicine. Dr. Boyd is one of an elite cohort holding the dual qualifications of veterinarian and physiotherapist, having graduated from the University of Sydney in 2011 and 2004 respectively. She has practiced in both roles before taking on a role as sports medicine veterinarian and physiotherapist at SASH. Naomi is currently undertaking a residency to become recognised as a veterinary sports medicine and rehabilitation specialist. She lectures on veterinary physiotherapy within Australia and internationally and has been a visiting lecturer to the Yamazaki Kakuin University in Tokyo. She has presented at an international symposium of veterinary rehabilitation in Vienna and was previously the vice chair for the APA Animal Physiotherapy Group. Naomi is also engaged in research and is currently studying gastrocnemius injuries in dogs. Hello, Naomi. Thank you so much for joining us on the Pure Animal Podcast. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm well. Thank you, Sarah. Thanks so much for having me on here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's so exciting to talk to you. You're a quite a unique vet that we have available to us in Australia in that you're a sports medicine vet and physiotherapist. So I'm really excited to talk to you today about the work that you do and about what sports medicine even is and how we can start to lean on what we're seeing happen in the human world of rehabilitation and osteoarthritis treatment and start to extrapolate those findings and different treatment options for our pets. So before we get into the sort of main bulk of the discussion today, I'd love to hear a bit about your background, why you actually wanted to become a vet and a physio, and how you ended up working for SASH in your current role.
So I started off as a physiotherapist, and as a physio, I worked with a lot of sports teams. I worked with some elite footballers out at Sydney Uni and a lot of ballet dancers. And I really enjoyed that part of my work. But what I really sort of I enjoyed the most was the workup of cases and getting to an answer and the cause. And I wanted to be able to stretch myself a little bit further, which is why I went into veterinary medicine. And during that time studying, I kept doing physio part-time.
Okay.
Yeah. And then when I graduated, I had full plans actually to be a mixed practice vet. But along the way, I did some work experience as an animal physio and discovered all the ways that I thought we could improve the care that we give dogs and cats and other animals. And I was very lucky that when SASH opened up their rehabilitation department, they asked me to come on board, and I've been there ever since.
Amazing. So how long is it since you started at SASH?
I've been here a bit over 4 years now.
Oh, right. Okay. And so is their sports medicine and rehab centre relatively new then? It's just been around for 4 years?
So they've had a rehabilitation sort of department here for quite a while before that, but it was more working in amongst the other teams with no specific space, whereas at that four-year mark, that's when we have our own area, we have our underwater treadmill, we have our gait analysis room, we have a full setup, which is really exciting and it's been really great.
Amazing. And so at SASH, you do obviously see physiotherapy cases for musculoskeletal problems, but there's other areas which you can use physio as a treatment for, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think probably most people in the community are familiar with physiotherapy for what they see it for, which is they go in for their sprained ankle or their sore back or things like that. And what a lot of people don't realise, unless maybe they've had a really unwell family member or the same thing has happened to them, is that there's actually physiotherapy in every public hospital, in every single ward in those public hospitals. And that's because if you go in for a general surgery, things like abdominal surgery, if you're in for definitely anything orthopedic or neurological, day one after your admission, you'll be assessed by a physio and set up with a plan to get you moving. And the other area that I think is also maybe a little bit under-recognized is our critical care and our intensive care patients, where there we have a physio plays a really, really important role in keeping those people moving or getting them back to mobility. Because the thing is, in public health, you know, where the whole system is set up to try and get people out of the hospital as quickly as possible to make it more efficient. And we know that if we keep people moving, their outcomes are better, whether it's for general surgeries, whether it's for orthopedic surgeries, or whether it's for really severe illness that ends them up in intensive care.
And is that, I mean, this is going to sound really silly, but the reason to keep them moving physiologically, is it to do with the flow of blood and the flow of lymph and maintaining muscle strength and keeping joints lubricated, sort of from a sort of pathophysiological point of view? What is what are the benefits of keeping pets and people moving when they're unwell?
Yeah, so all of those things, I think that the effect on the heart and the lungs is huge, and the cardiovascular system. So it has a huge impact on blood pressure and keeping that stable. The actually kind of the best evidence and the you know highest level one evidence that we have for physiotherapy is in cardiac and pulmonary rehabilitation, and preventing things like atelectasis either post-op or post-respiratory disease, working with patients on ventilators to get them off the ventilator faster, but then also making sure that they don't relapse and have to go back on the ventilator. And I think there's just so many widespread effects, you know, as you said, for cardiovascular effects, for respiratory, all the way through the body, and as well as mental health and making people feel good.
And so all of those touch points that we talked about for people, you're essentially starting to extrapolate the sort of data that we have from using those techniques in people for pets in SASH. Is that sort of something that you're focusing on?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think in some ways, as vets, we can be really good at making sure dogs go outside to toilet. But sometimes there can be a tendency to think that maybe more rest is better. And avoiding certain activities or avoiding certain things or overstressing an animal is definitely really important, but almost always making sure there's some mobility in that day is really important for all of those reasons.
Obviously, there's a huge role that physiotherapy plays in the treatment plans of lots of different conditions. But what I'd really love to chat with you about is sports medicine. So we know what sports medicine is in terms of the human world, but what is sports medicine in the veterinary world? What does it look like?
So I guess sports medicine in people was developed as a way to support people participating in sports or play, and that's for, you know, humans right from primary school age all the way up to elite athletes and then, you know, to masters level athletes who just want to play, do their weekend warrior stuff every Saturday or Sunday. And I think sometimes when we think about dogs, it's this idea that we only see agility or police dogs or things like that. But we, if we go back to that idea, is that we're supporting people in play, so movement and being able to participate freely in the things that you enjoy. What sports medicine is about is keeping dogs mobile and happy enough to do that. And for me, that's really one of the most lovely things. I mean, that feature is just so integral to dogs' quality of life, being able to let them move and do the things they love. And I guess in a practical sense, that means I see dogs for all kinds of lameness, all kinds of pain that affects their movement, any poor or abnormal movement, whether that's cropping up from joints or muscles or tendons, which we maybe don't do such a good a job of picking up muscle tendon injuries yet. And then obviously dogs after surgery or dogs with neurological conditions and things like that.
Yeah, okay. So if you were to see one of these patients, what does a workup look like from your perspective?
I guess it's the same as with any case. It can vary a lot.
Yeah.
And I think one of the good challenges, but definitely one of the challenges, is I do get a few referrals for cases where there's a few different problems lying over the top, where there's really curly cases where the signs are quite nebulous and vague, and you might end up going looking for a few different things. Generally speaking, we try and localize where we think the problem is coming from. So are we dealing with something musculoskeletal, or are we dealing with something neurologically, or very occasionally is it something that's medical, like an IMPA or similar?
Mm-hmm.
And then same as with other specialties, we go down that diagnostic path. For me, that more often than not involves some kind of imaging, whether that's just plain X-ray or CT or MRI here at SASH. We almost always use the gait analysis mat as well, and then see where that leads us and go from there.
Amazing. And the gait analysis mat is the only way to really objectively assess lameness from a sort of visual perspective, isn't it?
Yeah. So we have soft plates and we have pressure mats, and here at SASH we have the pressure mat, which is really useful because you've got a runway to walk your dog along.
Yeah.
And talking about, you know, we mentioned those kind of vague, nebulous cases where, you know, the dog will be lame briefly but recurrently when it plays exuberantly but then walks into the vet high on the adrenaline
normal.
And looks fine.
So frustrating.
Those annoying cases,
it's
great because you can get the dog doing a trot along the mat and you will pick up changes in their stride length and the pressure being put through the limb, and you can see that consistently and then use that not only to make sure that you're on the right track, but also to monitor if they're improving, which is really hard if you're not seeing the changes that the owners see in the consult, you know.
Yeah, of course. And so for a case like that had a really subtle lameness that wasn't sort of visually apparent all the time, but you picked up changes with the pressure mat gait, then would that then direct you to image a particular limb starting with X-rays, or is that sort of the stage that you use the pressure mat in terms of the workup?
I guess when it becomes really useful is when I have this report of lameness. It's not really obvious in the clinic. We make sure that what the owner reports matches up with what's actually happening with the dog, because we know that owners aren't always the best observers of canine gait.
Yeah.
And then I do a full orthopedic exam as normal, but we'll really hone in on that leg, and I'll make sure that I'll get into looking at each joint, looking at muscles and tendons really importantly, because again, we sort of kind of can skip over that. And then at that point, if I've got a nice feeling of where we're at, X-rays, ultrasound for muscles, or if I think that there's more than one area, we think of more like a CT.
Yeah. And so once you've you've essentially got your information from doing this comprehensive workup, then we're looking at a treatment plan. And obviously, in terms of physiotherapy that I've always been a part of, the treatment at home is really the mainstay of the treatment plan, because obviously they can't spend hours and hours and hours every single day with you in the clinic, even though that would be, you know, amazing if that was possible. So how are you empowering your pet parents to really take the lead in their treatment in their home environment to maximise its success rate?
So I'm really lucky, Sarah. I think I have two things on my side. One nice thing about working in sort of sports medicine or physio is that the owners that are coming to you are already motivated. So I generally my clients are really lovely and pretty keen to put in some work. The other thing that I have on my side is that dogs get treats for their exercises. And so they actually love it. And I've had a bunch of dogs over the years who, if owners have had a routine, like they do their physio at 3 o'clock every afternoon, the dog will go to the area where the physio is done and bark until owners will come over.
Because of the
so
food.
There's that kind of intrinsic motivation that maybe I would get at the gym if someone fed me chocolate for every sport I did.
Yeah, they should totally do that.
And I think the other thing is, like, as a human, your physio is can sometimes be seen as a bit of a chore. Definitely some of the things I ask owners to do can be seen maybe as a chore, but a lot of it is kind of like the same stuff that they would have done through puppy preschool times. You know, you're working with your dog a little bit as a team, and both people, and I think it's quite nice for owners to feel like they're really contributing to their dog's progress.
Yes.
So I think that helps.
Yep. And so in terms of like a typical treatment plan for a musculoskeletal issue, are you asking them to do a daily physio session at home, and then for how many weeks or how long? Is that a forever treatment plan to maintain the resolution of the issue, or what's the sort of typical plan look like?
So you're right. Everyone's got to tell me their sort of homework to be done. For most dogs, there's something small to do every single day. And often I'll ask them to do something a little bit more intensive or a little bit more time needed three times a week.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of how long that goes on for, it definitely depends on the dog. You know, your sort of standard recovery period to see a lot of changes in your soft tissues and in your joints is about 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And I talk to owners about being really diligent for 6 weeks. And then we might change the plan a little bit for the 6 weeks following that.
Yeah.
A lot of the things that I see are chronic. So in those chronic cases, we'll have a chat about this idea of working through whatever's caused the current exacerbation, whatever's really bothered them that they've come to see me, and then talk about not physio every day for the rest of their life, but more like, just like for ourselves, you know, we need to make sure that we're active, we're healthy. Maybe we do go to the gym twice a week, or we do Pilates twice a week, or whatever it is that supports our well-being.
Yeah.
And kind of introduce that into their normal routine. So hopefully I never make it too onerous, but we sort of talk about the ways we can make it part of their lifestyle so that it's ongoing and manageable.
Yeah, for sure. And are you also asking them to modify the exercise that the pet takes at home as well?
Yeah, in the early stages, I'd say for 99% of the cases I see, I feel like I do a lot of talking. We talk a lot about how we modify activity without stopping everything. Yeah.
And so things like jumping, stairs, twisting exercises, are they a real no-go from your perspective?
For most things, there can be a little bit of variation. You know, with muscle injuries, we might talk about specific movements that we want to avoid, but, you know, we're fine to jump off the couch, but we're not fine to run after a ball or something like that. But as a general rule, that it's the hard, fast movements and the quick changes of direction that are problematic. And I liken it to what we see with, you know, a footy player or a soccer player. You know, they often cope well with their normal daily activity and even training. It's when they go back to playing a game, not thinking about themselves or any sense of self-preservation, and throwing themselves into it at high speed, that's the problem.
Yeah, for sure. That makes total sense. And again, something that we can, you know, lean on learnings from human medicine for our pets, which is just becoming more and more possible these days, which is just so fantastic for us to be able to really utilize so many more different treatment options that are becoming more freely available. And so if your pet parent goes home with their treatment plan, are you asking them to purchase any specific tools or change anything in their home environment to be able to do these different daily treatments that you're asking of them?
I'm a really big believer in making things as accessible as possible. So there's definitely things that you can buy that just make things, it's simple to do exercises or whatever I've asked. But a lot of the time there's things that we can kind of DIY or borrow from normal home environment that means that anyone can do it. I think probably the biggest recommendation in terms of modifying the home environment is making sure animals on non-slip floors.
Mm.
I have had one owner who recarpeted her whole house on the basis of that advice, but most people pop down some yoga mats or buy their dogs some boots. So.
Okay.
So there's easier options.
Right. So boots is something that you recommend quite commonly?
Yeah, boots or what works nicely are those soft gel nail caps that you can buy for dogs. And it's kind of like taking the yoga mat and gluing it to their claws. And so for most dogs, it's really useful. And, you know, we've sort of seen these days, most people have floorboards or tiles in their houses and dogs are slipping and sliding. And this is just much easier than recarpeting or putting yoga mats down everywhere.
Yeah. So is that, I haven't really seen these. Is it something that you apply to the nail and then they stay on until they grow out? Or is it something that the owner puts on each day like a sock?
Yeah, no. You trim down the nail, they come with some glue, you glue the caps on and they kind of just snugly fit over. They're actually first, I think, developed to try and stop cats clawing furniture. It's such a bit cruel to use it in cats because they retract their claws.
Yeah.
But in dogs, we just pop it on, we trim off the excess and then they have some more grip.
Oh, that's so amazing. I'd love to see an image of that.
Yeah.
I'm assuming people get different colours.
Or black or your preferences.
Yeah, and I'm sure people go mad with sort of painting it with different nail polish colours and things. Okay, yeah. So but there's no sort of special, you know, bands or balls or anything that we might have for our physio treatments at home that you ask people to have. It's really just making sure that their environment is non-slip.
Yeah. But sometimes I'll suggest equipment, but if owners can't get it or it's a cost consideration, there's always ways around it. We want to make it work.
Not essential. Yeah. Okay. And so how often, you mentioned that you like to modify the treatment plan, say every 6 weeks for the first couple of times. And then do you often just let cases go once you're happy that they've resolved their issue? Do they sort of just go off into the ether, or do you actually like to see them back periodically, you know, in the long term?
It depends a little bit on the case. Isolated injury, so any kind of muscle injury is probably a really good example where I expect an excellent outcome. I expect it to be a nice defined recovery course. Then I want to send them off into the ether. I don't want to give them this idea that they have to keep seeing me to remain well. You know, my job is to enable them to go be happy and play. A lot of the things that we see, though, we expect some level of recurrence. You know, we think of dogs that have hip dysplasia, that go on to develop arthritis or go on to have surgeries, perhaps instead. You know, those kind of cases, I'll say to them, truly, you're better to come and see me earlier and let's hold off on surgeries if we can. Let's be really proactive rather than waiting till things are a bit desperate and then coming in, and then we have to start think about more sort of aggressive interventions. So
yeah, case dependent,
but be proactive if things aren't going well.
And just as a little tangent, so for a dog that is either genetically predisposed to hip dysplasia or unfortunately as a young dog has been diagnosed with hip dysplasia, what is a preventative plan in terms of preventing, you know, deterioration and slowing the progression of osteoarthritis in those joints? What does that look like from a physio and a sports medicine point of view?
So I think one of the things we have really, really nice data on from people is that we know if people have more muscle mass, and if they perform better on tests of strength, they're going to develop osteoarthritis from any cause, but hip dysplasia is a good example. Later, they'll develop it much later on. It'll progress more slowly. And if there is arthritis already associated with that, it'll take longer to become more severe. So these are the dogs where we talk about avoiding the hard, fast activities, or if they're young and exuberant, you know, just limiting it or the way that we can do it more safely, like playing in water.
Yeah.
And then they're the owners where I'm like, this is a dog where physio doesn't necessarily, maybe it's not every day, but it's definitely a part of every week if we want to avoid coming back to see me for something more aggressive as an intervention. Keeping muscle mass on them. Good quality food, regular walks and normal aerobic exercise as well. And that will really improve your joint health.
Yep. Okay. And what about swimming? Do you, because I know I've heard that, you know, swimming is obviously full of benefits, but also there's no weight bearing through joints. So What are your feelings about swimming as part of a you know, therapeutic exercise plan?
Yeah, so if we go to the example of, say, a young dog with hip dysplasia who we don't need to think about surgery at the minute, but we want to make sure we never have to if we can, I'll talk about exercise and water or hydrotherapy in two ways. One, we use it to let them have as normal a life as possible and as happy a life as possible, and that's playing in water. So particularly, like, I'll see eight-month-old dogs, who Labradors, who all they want to do is run around and be noodles. to tell people that that dog can't socialise or can't be silly or can't chase a ball, it's really hard.
Yeah.
So, you know, taking them to a dog beach, chasing a ball in the water, socialising around those kind of areas, letting them bound and play in a part where the impact is reduced because the water, is really useful.
Yeah.
And then the second part is using water as therapy. And for that, for those cases, if it's a joint disease as opposed to some others, I really want the dog weight bearing. I want them pushing off with their paws, because I know when the feet are in contact with the ground, that's when the stabilizing muscles and the muscles that are important for gait are being activated.
Right.
Swimming's great for aerobic fitness, for fun, but it's not going to get that muscular development, which is what I care about therapeutically.
Yeah, okay. That's really interesting. And any other source of exercise that you recommend other than, you know, just a sort of a good walk on a supportive surface and swimming? Is there anything, I know that you probably see quite a few sort of agility dogs and things. Is that something that you recommend, or is it too vigorous for some of them?
I guess in terms of, like, if incorporating stuff into a daily routine, incorporating going uphills can be useful for some owners. It's really accessible and has a bit more of that muscle targeting effect compared to just walking on the flat.
Yeah.
The other thing I recommend, not so much therapeutically, but a way to keep dogs mentally happy and mobile, is nose work. Instead of agility and fly ball and those kind of high speed, nose work gets them hunting out scents. It makes them work really hard cognitively.
Yep.
They love it. They're moving for it, but it's never particularly speedy. And it's been such a good thing for either those puppies that we have to limit what they're doing, or previously active dogs who are recovering from surgeries, or older arthritic dogs who, you know, may even have been done agility in the past. Really wonderful sport.
Yeah, amazing. And is that available to really any breed, or is it really just the sort of hounds and the retrievers?
I guess they have to be sort of scent focused. But any breed that's happy to do some work, which is, you know, the ones that will get involved.
Okay, and how do you recommend people learn about doing that? Do you have a program that you recommend, or anything online?
So generally I send them to a club. I'll email them details of a woman called Marion Brand who runs some nose work workshops and is part of a club, and I'll often send my clients there. Or if they're in an area that's where she's not so accessible, you know, I'll get them to do a bit of a Google search, because just like those agility clubs, there's the similar setups for nose work.
That sounds amazing. Well, hopefully they can go out and find some truffles and things like that.
coming into the really season. Cool stuff, actually.
Oh, so good. And so we've talked about some of the therapies that might be available for pets with osteoarthritis. What are some other new therapies that are on the horizon?
Arthritis is one of these diseases, I think, that can feel really frustrating. I see it all the time, and I think all vets see it all the time, right? It's part of our daily life. And we can sort of feel like we don't have a cure. But there is some new things. There are some new things coming out. So there's some medications that have been approved either in the US or over in the EU that will hopefully be here in Australia in the not-too-distant future.
Mm-hmm.
One of those is their anti-nerve growth monoclonal antibody factors.
Wow.
Which is a very, very long name.
But it's
essentially a drug that impacts on the anti-nerve growth factor and affects the way that it, or stops the way that it facilitates local inflammation and stops the sensitization of peripheral nerve endings.
Okay.
And the studies that have been done are quite promising.
Mm-hmm.
Is
that something, is that something that is already available in people?
You know, I think it has been developed, but because it's an antibody-based drug, they have to specifically develop it for canines and felines. Yeah. But I think it has come from people. I just haven't read that literature.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, interesting. Maybe it'll go the other way, the other direction. Maybe we'll utilize it in animals
first.
Yeah,
it might be the case we're actually closer to getting it more registered as well. But again, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds exciting.
And then the other one is Grappi plant or Galli plant, which is the brand name, which is over in the US. And this is a drug that antagonizes the EP4 receptor. So it's the receptor for our prostanoids that are released through the COX pathway. And so targeting it from a different way, making it hopefully a little bit more specific again, and maybe giving us an option for dogs who can't tolerate non-steroidals. So that we still need more data, I think, on the safety and long-term effects, but looking really promising. Okay. And then I think one of the talking points, or it's something that comes up in my day all the time, is CBD.
Yes, I was actually just thinking of asking you about that.
And so until fairly recently, I mean, here at SASH, we haven't recommended it. Just because there's an absolute smorgasbord of products out there that aren't regulated. They're more supplements than actual drugs. The quality of what is in them is really unknown. The concentration is unknown. The way it's prepared is all very variable. And at best, we're probably doing nothing with those preparations, but at worst, we're maybe doing some harm. But we have now got the ability to prescribe the human version as the off-label use. And there's three papers out that have been done in the US. We're hoping to run a trial here at SASH in the coming months as well.
Oh, wow.
And I think that could be an exciting alternative. And also I'm kind of excited just because a lot of owners are already trying to use it, but using these less than ideal preparations. So to have something that's, you know, formulated properly and reliable will be really great.
Yeah, absolutely. And so do you have to have a special license to prescribe the human CBD for off-label use as a vet?
No, you just have to do it as you would for any other off-label drug. I think the discussion that I have with owners is that, again, this is a drug that's very much in early use. We don't have all the safety data yet from the studies that are out there. It does elevate ALP in some cases. So therefore, we want to run blood before we put our patients on it. We want to make sure we're repeating that fairly regularly. We're not just letting that sort of drift off and monitoring for adverse effects.
Yep, of course. So every 3 to 4 months are you running bloods or every 6 months?
That's what I say, every 3 months earlier if something comes up.
Yeah, okay, great. And in terms of what you're seeing, I'm assuming you've got some patients on it already. So are you seeing good results anecdotally?
So we've only just started getting it underway. And I guess the trial that we're doing here at SASH is placebo controlled. So I don't have any really strong, hard feelings towards it yet, I'm excited to get a bit more idea of how good it is or not.
And with CBD, essentially we're trying to control the pain due to the osteoarthritis. Is there any evidence to suggest that it can modulate the pathology in the joint as well, or is it just related to pain perception?
All the studies that I've looked at have looked at pain, and so it acts centrally. The other kind of cool thing is that there's receptors for our cannabidiols in joints, so it potentially has a peripheral effect as well. I don't know anything. I haven't read anything convincing about cartilage health.
No, me neither. Yeah.
So far, yeah.
And in terms of cartilage health, are you recommending any other supplements as a preventative in at-risk dogs for osteoarthritis or cats?
Yeah. So I think the most comprehensive evidence we have today is still for our omega-3s and our fish oil.
Yep.
I think there's some nice studies looking at greenlit mussel and the other supplements that are promising, but I guess they're early. We just like to see more of it confirming the findings we're seeing of Boswellia and curcumin have quite promising results in some large effect sizes, which is nice.
Yep. And again, they're quite commonly reached for in human medicine. So it makes sense that we'll be able to see similar results certainly in dogs.
And I think one of the other things that's sort of come through that we can look at human data for is platelet-rich plasma. There's a systematic review that came out only very recently looking at it in knee osteoarthritis for people and finding that there was a good amount of evidence to recommend its use. So it's also a promising option.
And is that something that's injected into the joint space?
Yeah, so with the platelet-rich plasma, or PRP, we collect the blood, we spin it down to get that platelet-rich concentrate. Mm-hmm. The idea being that we know platelets are really critical for things like wound healing. So they have all of these growth factors, all of these cytokines that trigger a response to get tissue laid down and organized. And so taking that concentrate of that and then injecting it into the joint to, you know, I explain it to owners as kind of kickstarting that healing process again and modulating the inflammation, which is what helps with the pain.
Yeah, for sure. Because as we know with arthritis, it's a bit of an inflammatory cascade effect that's going on within the joint. So as much as we can sort of put a stop to that or slow that down is only going to slow down the progression of the disease and hopefully reduce the pain associated. So other therapies that you reach for, sort of, you know, non-pharmaceutical, non-supplement, are you doing any acupuncture or dry needling or any laser therapy in your practice?
So we do laser therapy, and I'm very lucky. Clara, one of our anaesthetists, she does dry needling with dogs here for pain. And I think it has fairly good evidence behind it for managing pain. I was lucky with laser. So there's really only one really good study looking at laser in dogs with OA. And I was talking to one of the people involved in the study at the conference, and they ran it. They ran the study twice because the first time they ran it, they didn't see any results. And so then they doubled the dose and they got really nice results.
Oh, and good I think for them.
And it's one of those stories that you just have to be in the right place at the right time to know the background. But it's really made me rethink my way of using it day to day and making sure that probably we need to rethink our doses a little bit in our laser therapy.
Is there any side effects to using laser therapy?
If it's used safely, no, there shouldn't be any side effects. Mm-hmm. If you were to go too crazy with the dose, you know, you can cause burns and things like that. Okay. I would tell owners that the laser that we have, if we put a different end on it, we could use it as a surgical laser.
Right, yeah, that's probably good.
The power is there.
Yeah, that's a good way to explain to them, yeah. Oh, amazing. Well, it sounds like there's so many treatment options that we have available for osteoarthritis. In terms of some of the other cases that you're seeing, so particularly around other, you know, soft tissue musculoskeletal cases, is it really the physiotherapy and the hydrotherapy that you're focusing on, or are you using any of these other dry needling and laser for those as well?
So I think the role of dry needling is generally to manage the pain as a side effect. The way I think of it is it's one of my tools that lets the dog feel more comfortable, and then we can start to be more active, and then we can build on the strength or motor control in a way that we couldn't do if the dog was painful and limited by that.
So yeah, for
that's
sure.
That's how I sort of think of those things, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. So we reduce the pain first so that the dog is more willing and more able to comfortably perform the physio exercises, and then build the strength, and then hopefully that will enable less need for the pain relief in that sort of cycle. Would that be the right way of thinking of it?
That's how I think about it. Our acupuncture gives us that break. It's our symptom management to let us then build resilience in our patient and build them up and then set them free onto the world.
Yeah, for sure. And is that how you're thinking of pharmaceutical pain relief as well? Are you trying to just use it in that initial treatment phase in a short-term way to then enable the physiotherapy to be done more comfortably and then hopefully wean them off?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, not all cases that is possible, and that I definitely have a lot of dogs that need the support of analgesia all the time.
Yeah.
But again, sort of leaning a little bit into human medicine, we more and more see that if you're dosing the same dose every day and it's not responsive to what's happening in your day and how you're responding to your activities, we're not getting the best out of our pain management. And I'll talk to owners. I spend a lot of time talking about different ways of monitoring your dog and how to get an idea of what is working and is this a bad day or a good day, and then using our pain relief judiciously around that. I'm very pro having that on hand, and it's not something I want to hold back on at all. But if we can time it a little bit better and make sure that our, you know, our short acting drugs, we're using them for the times when it's needed. We don't necessarily need to give gabapentin overnight all the time, or maybe paracetamol overnight when we know it has effects that aren't needed when the dogs aren't moving.
Yeah, okay. And so just before we sort of finish up, because we are getting close to time, I'd really love to hear a little bit more about how you're asking your pet parents to monitor comfort levels at home. Are they filling in a sort of a, you know, assessment chart, or how are you instructing them to do that? That's really interesting to me.
Yeah, so I do a couple of things. I use the Canine Brief Pain Inventory, which is just a 10-question questionnaire, and that's really easy to implement and takes 2 seconds. And that's what I'll do when they come in for their rechecks. At home, I encourage owners to pay attention to not so much what happens directly after activity, but what they're like first thing in the morning, particularly after new activity. And see if they're, because that tells me, what that tells me is how they recovered. I'm not too fussed generally, particularly in my chronic cases, if a dog is more sore after a walk or more sore after physio, as long as we're recovering from it fully.
That makes sense. And then, so it's the next morning.
And then to make that a little bit more objective, because we can all put on our, you know, rose-tinted glasses or otherwise, I ask owners to video their dog once a week at the same time of day, once a week or once a fortnight, just so that they have something they can kind of look back and compare to.
That's a good idea.
And if we do ever have a hiccup, I ask owners to think about what the dog did in the previous 48 hours, which they're pretty good at doing. The other thing is, did anything change globally day to day 2 weeks earlier? Because we know we see the impact of the accumulation of small activities, like a small increase every day, about 2 weeks after introducing that.
I would never have thought that it would take that long. But I guess it's the accumulative effect.
And so you think like puppies being introduced into a house and an old dog suddenly being harassed by a puppy, they're fine for the first 2 to 4 weeks. And then suddenly the wheels fall off for no reason that owners can work out that the puppy came a month ago. That was the cue.
Oh, that's really interesting. And that's really, really helpful. There's some practical tips there for our listeners to take on board, vets and pet parents alike.
That's good.
Naomi, this has been such an amazing conversation. Before we finish up, is there anything else that you wanted to share with our audience about this topic?
Oh, I don't know, Sarah. I think I've talked a lot.
I think we've covered a lot of different things. It's been great.
I guess if I had to say one thing, I think sometimes physio is seen as like the icing on the cake. You know, it's for the extra dedicated owners or the people that have more time or maybe more financial ability. And I would really encourage everyone to reframe that entirely. Physio is what will keep you out of the vet clinic. It's what will save you the $5,000 surgery. It will stop you having to see or have more expensive things done or more time-consuming things done. And thinking about all this mobility and general wellness in movement early on is so great for prevention, and it should be part of every patient.
I love that, and I completely agree. And for the welfare of the animal as well, you know, all of these other things that they may reach in terms of surgery and more invasive treatments. You know, yeah. They're not something that we would ever wish upon anyone. So if we can utilize these really nice sounding different therapies that are available as a preventative, yep. then we're looking after their mental and their physical well-being.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I love that. That's a really nice way to finish our chat today. Thank you so much, Naomi. It's been wonderful chatting to you. We'll definitely have to have you back one day. I'm really interested to hear the results of the CBD trial that you've got ongoing at the moment. So maybe we can have you back to chat about those findings when they're available.
That'd be fantastic. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks, really Naomi. Have a great day. This was the Pure Animal Podcast, and I'm Dr. Sarah Howard. If you would like to share this episode with a friend, please feel free to go into iTunes and give us a rating and review.